Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today we go back in time about 2 weeks to hear from the main speakers at an event called What Happened in Syria, which was sponsored by the Guelph Bridging Group together with PeaceWriters.org, Council of Canadians, Muslim Society of Guelph, and the Guelph Students Association of the University of Guelph. For over 7 years, a civil war has been raging in Syria between the government of Bashar al-Assad and a complex and shifting group of rebel factions, including famously the terrorist group Daesh. 500,000 people have been killed, millions more have been turned into refugees, and there's still no end in sight as the international community seems either unwilling or unable to work towards peace. The humanitarian crisis of our time is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, almost 7 years and 1 month to the day that the Syrian civil war started, members of the Guelph community came out in the midst of a rare winter storm in April to get a better understanding of the conflict. Because of the local response to the refugee crisis, a unique relationship has been built between the Guelph community and its new members who immigrated here from Syria. But how many of us can say that we fully understand the reasons that brought our new Syrian friends here in the first place? Well, that's what this event was for, and there were two speakers. The first is Monia Mazing. She is an academic, author, and human rights advocate. Her memoir, Hope and Despair, My Struggle to Free My Husband, Mararar, is an account of her vigorous campaign to secure her husband's release from detention and torture in Syria and of her struggle to clear his name. With her latest book, Hope Has Two Daughters, Mazing weaves a bracing and vividly told story set against the backdrops of the Tunisian bread riots in 1984 and the Jasmine Revolution in 2010. The book is a rare glimpse inside the revolution from the perspectives of two women, a mother and a daughter, who take active roles during these pivotal moments in their history. Mazing's other works include Mirrors and Mirages, a finalist for the Trillium Book Award in the original French. And the second speaker is Haroon Siddiqui. He is the editorial page editor emeritus at the Toronto Star and a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. His citation for the Order of Canada reads, Haroon Siddiqui is a highly respected journalist. He has been an advocate for fairness and equality of opportunity. He has challenged stereotypical thinking about minorities through his newspaper articles and public appearances, calling for active involvement of new Canadians in mainstream society. He has encouraged dialogue and understanding. Editor emeritus at the Toronto Star, he continues to promote acceptance in our pluralistic society and a broader role for Canada in the global village. About 100 people attended the talk at Harcourt United Church, but you will be able to hear it for yourself on this week's podcast. Mazing and Siddiqui respond to the U.S. missile attack launched in retaliation for the latest chemical weapons attack. They also talk about the need to keep up the pressure on politicians to act on behalf of the Syrian people, and they talk about how Islamophobia here at home hurts the cause of helping Muslims in crisis abroad. So let's hear the lecture, which took place on April the 14th here in Guelph.
Thank you very much. I will start with saying peace upon you, everyone. Assalamu alaikum. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you for inviting me to Guelph. It's really an honor and a privilege for me to speak with you and to maybe have a conversation later on about this very actually timely topic, but also a very difficult and complex topic, which is what is happening or what happened in Syria. I am going to start, or maybe my notes or my reflection with you this afternoon. And before I go any further, also I would like to thank everyone, all the volunteers, all the groups, all the sponsors who made my presence here with you possible. Thank you very much for that. So my reflection are going to be based on around three aspects, and I will start maybe the first aspect, which is, I think, I wouldn't say the easiest, but maybe the less controversial one, is about Syria, the country. What do you know about it? And then the second thing would be my personal experience with Syria, with the Syrian regime, and with the Syrian people. And my third level or aspect would be, I would say, what can we do from there, from these three, like two already aspects of that. So if you want really to really maybe summarize or understand where I'm coming from here in this discussion, is that I'm not coming from as an academic or an expert or someone who is going to bring you the truth. As it was already mentioned, that we know that the first casualty of war is the truth. And I don't pretend that I hold that truth. However, I think there is something in my life that would be that brought me to see things that I would like to share with you. And this is what I would love this afternoon to do. The first thing I mentioned, what is this country, Syria? Because, I mean, Canada received officially, especially after the current government came, and this is maybe something else to reflect upon it, because the previous government was, in a way, for ideological reasons and for political reasons, were kind of opposing the coming of the refugees, and especially the Syrian refugees. And then with the new government, I think Canada, and especially the Canadian, got whatever they wanted to. So here we are. We have Haroon Siddiqui with us. So maybe... sure. I thought maybe we can switch and you can start. maybe the mentioning of Stephen Harper brought you here. I don't know. so anyway, this is what I was saying, is that I think the Canadian population was able to maybe do, and at least a big portion of Canadians spoke and were able to see that they wanted to do something in helping in this crisis happening over there. However, I have to say that Syria is also somehow, before the war, was not a place that a lot of people heard about or maybe knew about. So what is this country that today everybody, even Trump, is really talking about it and has an opinion on that? I am married to a husband, my husband is Syrian, and I got to know myself. Even like for me, born and raised as a Muslim, I got to know people who are different, another civilization, another food, another kind of tradition, culture, even another dialect as well. So it's not because we are Muslim or from certain region of the world that we are going to know each other necessarily and have the same food taste or the same dialect or the same sort of upbringing in life. However, I think what it is important here to remember is that Syria, it's not a country that was created in the last centuries or, you know, couple of 100 or 300 years. We are talking here about a civilization of thousands of years. We are talking here about the cradle of civilization. We are talking about Ebla, that is supposed, considered to be very close to Idlib. Maybe you have heard of that city recently in the news, but Ebla is really 3,000 years before the Common Era, where there are writings that have been discovered, where there is. So we are talking here not about people that have been so much dehumanized in the media coming here because they are looking for food or for jobs. We are talking about displacement, destruction of culture, destruction of communities, destruction of civilization. And what is sad for me, as a Muslim, I know all culture, they do have their legend. And one of these legends that, you know, we hear in schools when we were growing up is that there are two main places in the Muslim world that are so famous you cannot forget, and it's Baghdad and Damascus. And it is so sad to see today that Baghdad has been destroyed and Damascus as well. So you have this golden era in the Muslim world that was first in Damascus with the Umayyad Mosque. It is really one of the first mosques that was established after the companion of the Prophet Muhammad came out of Arabia and started to discover that there are other places of the world. And of course, Damascus is one of these great cities, and that existed before even the Islam, but it became later on as a very important platform or a hub. I knew when I was asked to write when the refugees came in or started to come in Ottawa, in Canada in 2015, I was asked by a public health doctor that I walk together with, and she said, why don't you write me that kind of a brief overview of Syria, the economy? And this is why I thought, this is great. This is what we should do to people, you know, tell them who are these people who are coming here. So Damascus also became a very important place, even in the Muslim world later on, when the Ottoman came, and the Ottoman Empire had different kind of cities, and one of them is Syria, with many cities of like Damascus, Aleppo as well. And Damascus became this place where all the pilgrimage around the world, in order to go to Mecca, will stop there. So it became also very flourishing and, you know, city as well. Aleppo is another place that has been tremendously affected by the war, as you can see, as you can know. Maybe it is this place that was divided between the regime forces and between the opponents that came to be known mainly in the West as ISIS, because this was something I would say sell very well, but nevertheless, some of them are legitimate opponents to the regime, and many of the houses were destroyed. Even the fort of Aleppo, that is a place of thousands of civilization, was touched as well in that war. So, I mean, those things, maybe some of you know about them, but I think it's always good to remember that we are not talking here about any sort. And I'm not trying to say that some refugees are worth mentioning and others are not. I think I'm trying to see the bigger picture here. We are not seeing people only coming here who are vulnerable, who are avoiding war, but also we have to think about what brought these people here. And during some of my interaction with refugees from Syria, many of them said, we don't want to be here. And I think this is very important, not because they don't like Canada, but I think because they love where they are. They love that place where they grew up. They love the food. They love everything. So I think it's very hard to, you know, to leave those things despite the war. But nevertheless, sometimes you have to take those decisions and you have to uproot yourself and start all over again. So this is something, aspect I wanted to share with you. Also, I think the other thing is that We in Canada, we always, I mean, at least some of us look at themselves or at themselves like as a multicultural place to be. Well, Syria, speaking of multicultural, Syria is a place of really civilization living together for many, many years, like thousands of years. There are communities still who speak the Aramaic in Syria, and this is supposed to be the language of Jesus Christ. So we are here not in front of just a monolithic block of people who are all looking this way, eating the same way. You know, we are talking about a diversified community. And Syria, if we talk about, you know, people who are Christian, who are Druze, who are even within Muslim, like some of them are Alawite, some of them are, you know, they are really a very good representation. Unfortunately, that aspect of diversity has been, I think, used in a kind of a Machiavellian way by the by this current regime to say, see, I was able to offer stability so far. I was able, because of my secularism, because of this, because of, you know, we were able to bring people together. But this is not right. Syrians have been living, even before Bashar al-Assad, together, Christian together. But I think this regime has portrayed himself as the savior of the minorities. So we have to be careful when we hear this sort of argument. It's not all angelic. It's not all true. The other thing is also I would like to very briefly, because we have a lot to cover and I don't want to take all this time to be talking. I think we can also have a discussion or conversation together. It's about Syria, the modern Syria, or the how Syria maybe appeared. Because to be careful here, the region was not maybe always known as Syria, because that was called, I mean, this is why you hear the Levant, so it's more really like Bilad al-Sham. Bilad al-Sham, that covers Palestine, that covers Jordan, that covers Syria, and that covers Lebanon. And the word for Syrian people who are from Damascus, they call themselves Sham, so that means they are from Damascus. So it's really like, what is Sham? What is the Levant? You know, those are just different names to say for sometimes Syria, but also it can be for Damascus to call it as Sham. That means Damascus. But I mean, before the Bilad al-Sham was that whole region, and then in the modern time they started calling the Republic of Syria. So that's the what you see on the map today, that's Syria. But even like Syria is even larger than this. The Sham, the Levant is even broader than this. And I think this is after the Psycho Pico, after the World War I, this is how the British and the French decided to divide the world. And Syria came under the French mandate. So not for a long time compared to, for example, Tunisia or for Algeria, where it was a whole colonization of 100 of years. In Syria, the French were there. And after the French signed some sort of the independence, then there were some different governments. So those governments were not very kind of, I would say, successful in keeping some sort of continuing ruling. And in the 50s and then later on in the 70s, the current family, the Assad family, with a father who had made a coup and then came from the military and took power. And since Syria has been living under the emergency laws, so we are not talking here, you know, about a democracy. What this Assad regime is supposedly to be a secular regime, so this is why some people, even in the West, they would justify the killing, saying we'd rather have the devil that we know rather than the devil that we don't know, and the other devil is understood to be maybe the Islamic extremist. So I think the father came in 73, I think, and then he started that ruthless, really ruthless governing, where, I mean, a lot of human rights abuses were justified. At that time, especially because of, you know, the region, the dynamic, the international context, the Cold War, and one of the first things also I think it's good to remember is that the interest of the Russian into Syria. Because what we see today, in order to understand what's going on today, we have to look at, you know, so the interest of Russia in Syria is not new. It has been really a military, a geostrategical, so, and also in a way an ideological, because of the socialist kind of, I would say, but the socialist aspect of the Assad regime, I think there was also some affinities to look for there. So military, cultural, and then political also as well. So for 73 until 2000, when the father died, there were waves and waves of people who were put in prison, who were killed, who disappeared. So we are not talking here about something that happened only after the war. So this is something people should remember. In the 80s, there was a big massacre in a city town called Hama. And there are very little things known up to today about what happened exactly, but it is apparently like the figures are of 10,000 people who were disappeared, crashed, because they were they stood up and they thought that they can oppose the regime. And many of them were part of the kind of the Islamic opposition. When I say Islamic opposition, maybe I have to be here clear about it. So we are not talking about people taking the arm we are talking about ideology, like, you know, saying that, oh, why don't we bring Islam as a way to rule our affairs instead of having other kind of ideology. So, and then, so I think in 2000, the father died, and then there is the son. The son, the one that is today the president of Syria, was not really the politician. He is the doctor. He is someone who went to Britain, to the UK, and got a doctor degree. He's an eye doctor. So from there, and married to this very fancy and British kind of raised Syrian over there, working in the finance high finance sector. So I think when this couple came, a lot of expectation were built on. And one of them, again, it was even before the Arab Spring, there was something called the Damascus Spring. That was in 2000. And what happened is that a lot of authors, writers, intellectuals, activists, who and different ideologies, some of them more like Muslim, Islamic kind of thinking, some other more like secular or closer to, you know, socialist or social democrat thinking, and they came together, and, you know, there were cafe, there were a lot of group meeting, and they were kind of testing the regime. And I think at that point the regime was tolerating a little bit, and they saw it as a sign of openness to the regime. So all the hopes were, you know, put there. But then unfortunately what happened is that the regime, as if, you know, it's not only Bashar al-Assad here, we are talking about a group of people who are part of the Alawites. So it's really a sect to speak of or a part of, you know. So this is they are the one who are basically ruling. So the president is not even, I mean, even the president is not the real here person taking all the decision. So and then again there was an attack on the dissidents. Many of them were put in prison, and many of them had to leave the country. So now I'm going to link it to my personal here. I think I will stop there, and I will link it to. I met my husband in Canada. He's from Syria. I'm from Tunisia, and his family came to Canada in the 80s. And this is also something to keep in mind that. Yes, the Syrian refugees now are very, I mean, we hear about them, but there were a lot of people in the 70s, in the 80s, after that massacre, who left Syria, mainly to the United States, some to Europe, and some also to Canada. And those are not always politically, or like my in-laws are not people who are politically involved, or really, you know, I think it's more people who are looking for opportunities, better opportunities for their children. And also Syrian, I was talking about all this kind of past and long history. I mean, many of them are merchant, and they are, you know, those people who travel the world. Many of them went at some point when the Ottomans were in power, and they made it as obligatory for the male to join the military and fight in other place of the Ottoman Empire. Many of the male went to South America. Many of them came to the United States. So people had waves always to leave oppression or to look for better economic opportunities. And I think my in-laws were one of these who were looking for better opportunities. And I met my husband at McGill University, and you know, we got married, and we got married in Montreal in 1994. And we moved to Ottawa later on. 2002, my husband was arrested. We were in Tunisia on vacation, and he was coming back to Canada, and he was arrested. And my husband, when he arrived to Canada, he never came back to Syria again. So for him, it was like Canada was the country where he wanted to live. But also for another kind of practical reason, there is a military service, a mandatory for all the boys who are over 18, and he didn't want to do that. And the military is another ruthless place also to be in Syria because of the nature of the military over there. This kind of sectarianism, you know, the minority who are the Alawite ruling over the Sunni. If you are Sunni, then they are, you are the one that we are going to make you, humiliate you, because we are the one who rule, even if we are a minority. So a lot of levels really here that we have to always keep in mind when we have tackled the Syrian issue or the Syrian war. So my husband was arrested by the American, and then from there he was deported, or I would say shipped to Syria. And what is interesting, because we think at that time, in 2001, George W. Bush identified 6 rogue states, and one of them was Syria. So you would wonder, how come that we have here a state that is rogue? So whether, I mean, this is another problem. I mean, are they, what does it mean, rogue? But okay, assuming that they are rogue states. And so how come that, you know, you send someone that you don't like or that you suspect of being a terrorist, right, associated with Al-Qaeda? This is what they told my husband in the US on a piece of paper. So how can you send someone to a place where that you consider as a rogue state? Something very interesting here that happened after 9/11. And this is something that Seymour Hersh, who is a journalist, investigator, journalist, very well known, spoke about. I think it has a lot of, again, truth in there, is that what happened after the 9/11, the Syrian regime gave thousands of files of their own people, of their own Syrian, to the American. So they gave them thousands of files on Syrian who are supposedly to be Islamic sympathizer or Islamic terrorist. And that move was away from the Syrian government, and this is not me saying that, this is what this journalist had been saying, and I think it has some sort of a truth in there, was a kind of a backdoor, a kind of an indication of their goodwill to negotiate when it comes to the Israeli-Palestine war as well. So you see how, again, this is... I sell my people, I give my people, and those files, I don't know whether, you know, they are credible or not, but they did that, and they sent those files. So Syria has been a rogue state, but also an ally in the war of terror. So you see, everything is here, multi-leveled, very complex, not black and white. So it is, so when they send someone from the U.S. to Syria with this tag that he isn't associated with Al-Qaeda, so that means you are, I mean, we gave you that one of yours, so deal with that one of yours and do whatever we cannot do on the American soil. So torture that person, get extract information you want. And this is what happened to my husband. It's like, you know, the dirty job that the American do not do there and that the Canadian in a way also did not do, but then they had subcontracting the Syrian there. And Syria has been doing that a lot. So, yeah, to go back to that personal story, again, I think this is something that, of course, obviously affected me a lot, affected my family, and even my in-laws who are Syrian, they felt powerless. Because you leave a place you don't know already. I mean, you leave the place knowing that it's a lot of nepotism, a lot of connection there, a lot of really injustice, and then you come here and you think that things will change, but then you find yourself here considered as maybe a foreigner, kind of half citizen, maybe not totally loyal, and then found yourself in the United States, caught into this war on terror. So I think this is also, it shows how Syria is a very, very difficult place. It's not a regime that is easy to handle. It's not a regime that is easy. And then there is also the other thing that the regime has been portraying itself as, you know, I am the defender of, I am the resistor to the Israeli hegemony, I am the defender of the Palestinian. But then the prison or the detention center, you know, that where my husband was detained is called the Palestinian branch. So whoever is take the arms and try to resist the Israeli whatever without the consent of the regime, then is supposed to be like a bad guy or opponents and then kept into that detention. So I don't want to really, I don't know if this is what I'm saying to you, I don't want to confuse you because this is so confusing, but I think the purpose of what I'm saying here is that what we hear in the media, what we read, is not all easy to process. But what I would like people maybe to remember here is that, remember those people. Remember those people over there. Because I think here in Canada, no matter what we say, no matter how we criticize ourselves, no matter how we, you know, we say, I think we have one single privilege. That means to live in peace and to not live in with the threat of bombs coming over our head. And this sort of brief moment, I mean, I'm not saying maybe we are going to have war here, but we can never know what can happen. But this moment of respite, of peace, we have to use it to make differences. And I would like to, you know, I'm going to hear maybe to end a little bit long, but end because I was reading this. It's the Literary Review of Canada, and it's interesting to see how the title. It's the most recent review here, issue. Sorry, and it's called The Collapse of Syria. That's the main title of it. And there is a very interesting it's a review of two books. One of the book, probably, it's very coming. It's about that little boy, Alan Kurdi, the one that all the world, and this is how people started really accepting, in a way, refugees, in a kind of, so his aunt, Fatima Kurdi, she lives in Vancouver, and she wrote a book, so it's coming soon, so there is a review of that book. But there is another review also about another book. It's called No Turning Back, Life, Loss, and Hopes in Wartime Syria. And this is a book about a journalist. Her name is Rania Abu Zaid. And I didn't read the book, but I read the review. And it is very, very interesting because I would like really to share with you some of what she said, or what the journalist who made the review said, because there is something about Canada there. In the process, she uncovers, it's Rania who wrote that book about Syria. In the process, she uncovers layers of meaning behind the fragmentation, so the fragmentation of the opposition, because the opposition is so fragmented. She notes how, for instance, the young activist who led the early days of the protests, and this is very important because it's not always the politician that we are seeing today or those armed group that they started this war. It was those young people, and I think this is what we should always remember. So the young activists who led the early day of the protests refused to work with a burgeoning group of aging exiles and regime defectors congregating in Turkey. And here she is quoting, we felt very strongly that we didn't want to work with anybody over the age of 40. I am one of them. So I don't feel offended. One activist told Abu Zaid, so they had their turn in the last era. They failed. We wanted to be different. These young upstarts begged the international community for help. The world ignored them, fretting over phantom Islamist in the midst, a narrative concocted by the regime and injected with reality after Bashar al-Assad ordered the release of hundreds of jailed Islamists in May and June of 2011. So that was after the protest started, so he released that. That created a bigger mess. Even as the regime security apparatus began to kill protesters and hundreds disappeared into Syria's dungeons, never to be seen or heard from again, world leaders offered little more than platitudes. We are behind you. Probably this is what Obama said. They said, like cheering spectators. There were exceptions. One former Canadian diplomat I interviewed, so that's the journalist who was writing the review, so he interviewed that diplomat, in 2016, tried to do more. When he was stationed in Ankara, the Turkish capital, he met secretly with Syrian youth movement and, against the orders of his superiors, helped them strategize and offer whatever material support he could. He traveled to Syria illegally to see firsthand the suffering and of the displaced, and smuggled a computer program into the country to help activists communicate without being found or out by the regime. The action alone, one activist told me, likely saved dozens, if not hundreds, of lives. As a reward from Canada, he was transferred to a desk job in Africa and was ultimately forced to retire. So I just wanted to share that with you because I thought that this kind of explain as Canada, for example, this is what where we are. Yes, we did some good work of accepting, but also I think we could have done more before and we could do more better. Politically speaking, I mean, we had here the example. I'm not bringing that example. This is the journalist talking with, you know, about something. He obviously interviewed that person. So there are little actions that can be done, and they can bring a lot of good. And I think today, I mean, we have here a president bombarding Syria. We have Canada supporting those bombardment. Personally, I mean, I'm not someone who would think that war is going to solve issues. I mean, if they wanted to get rid of Bashar al-Assad, they could have done the first years. So their target is not obviously Bashar al-Assad. Their target is not the oppressor. Their target is more political motivated, geostrategically motivated. It's a war between the US and Russia. And of course, Syria is a very good, very good victim here, unfortunately. What bothers me here, I think, a little bit, and maybe if you hear that within your friend or group, and you know, some people who are sometimes good-meaning, but sometimes very much ignorant, they would say, "Oh, you know what? We don't want the American to bomb Syria, whatever. Fine, but where were you when the Russian were bombing Syria? Where were you when Bashar al-Assad was throwing these barrels over his people?" So I think people, when they have pick and choose, you know, who is the good bombarder and who is the bad bombarder, who is the imperialist and who is bad. I don't think we should let them speak. I mean, maybe they can speak, but we should correct their facts, I think. That's very important. At the end of the day, once again, these are communities that are destroyed. These are women who are, rooted from their houses, from their families. And I think we should be, I think Karen spoke about compassion, empathy, and I think we should keep that. I think this kind of empathy, what does it mean? That means it's not you are going to be good, you are going to try to feel the others and try to be in the shoes of the other. And my husband sometimes tell this, as a joke, but also as a bitter joke. There are people on the internet who say, you know, oh yeah, there is a propaganda against Bashar al-Assad, he's not a monster, whatever. And then those people, they have no clue about what it means to live in Syria under al-Assad. And he said, if you get one slap, you will change your mind about that regime. And I think this is what people should. It's not easy for people to live under the regime at that time, and today it's not easy to live under the bombardment, whoever are those bombarding coming from. So I think we should keep our heart open. Our politician also should be informed. They should help with not only the refugee coming, but also settling here. And then most of all, correcting these kind of facts. These are not job stealers. These are not people who are going to bring Sharia. These are not people who are going to bring barbaric practices. These are people who have thousands of years of civilization, very good food, and also a lot of generosity, and I think we should look at that. But at the end of the day, we are all half devil, half angel, so we cannot really blame people for their behavior. We have to, you know, blame their circumstances and try to understand and try to help. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you all for coming on horrible day. Haven't seen snow pellets and rain and cars in the ditches since I left Manitoba 40 years ago. It's just a horrible thing. Anyway, just to pick up on what Monia was saying about the old civilization that Syria is, she was referring to the Prophet Muhammad. Before he became a prophet, he did a business trip, of all places, to Damascus. That's one. I have three lamps in my house that are hanging from the ceiling that were bought on Jesus Street in Damascus. I'm from India, and if you look at the map of India, in South India, we have Syrian Christians who came to India in the first century, followers of Thomas the Apostle. In South India, in a place called Cochin, there is a synagogue which is deemed to be the world's oldest synagogue, or one of the. And it was built, among other people, by Jews from Aleppo. So this is an extraordinary country that has been ruined, civilization completely lost. And we speak of the bad guy, Bashar al-Assad, which he is undoubtedly. Next door civilization that Munya mentioned, Baghdad, another great civilization, bombarded and destroyed by our forces led by the United States. So we have these two great civilizations, Islamic Muslim civilizations, that have been destroyed by one known bad guy, the others who pretend to be good guys but have not been. And then we invoke the name of a president, the current president, as you know, of course, has started the bombing last night. At one level, it's obviously a good response, because you can't let chemical attacks and so on go unpunished. Because if you remember Barack Obama, whatever one thought of him, he drew this so-called red line in Syria and never followed up when the chemical weapons were used, and he kept quiet. So America felt the need to do so. But the real issue is, as Munya mentioned, what good would it do? Would it do any good, any better than what Mr. Trump's cruise missiles attack roughly about the same time last year did? It mangled some planes, killed 11 civilians, and nothing changed. Would this round of bombing change anything? You know, would it topple Mr. Bashar al-Assad, for example? But Theresa May last night said, oh, it's not about regime change. We don't want to change the regime. So what are you doing it for? Would it reverse the war, for example, that Mr. Bashar al-Assad has almost won, and the people backed by the West have lost, and lost badly? Would it change that balance and the equation? Obviously not. Question then is, what is the point of this cruise missile attacks? Is there something to it that escapes us, ordinary people? Would this round of cruise missiles make any more difference than Bill Clinton firing cruise missiles, if you remember, in Sudan on a chemical factory, claiming that it was making chemical bombs and so on? It turned out to be a pharmaceutical factory making much needed antibiotics, aided by Great Britain and Germany. Would this do any more than Mr. Clinton's landing cruise missiles in Afghanistan, saying there's a summit of the terrorists taking place and Mr. Bin Laden is there? It ended up killing lots of goats and some camels and no Bin Laden. And Bin Laden survived to mount 9/11 in the end. One doesn't want to be too cynical, but let's hear what Mr. Trump said last night. He said it's in the vital security interests of the United States. How so? Landing 10, 20, 40, 50, 100 missiles, how does it advance the security interests of the United States? It's beyond comprehension. The American president say this by rote, because they have to justify these things. And he said, he blamed Assad last night. Of course, everyone blames him, and he should be blamed, as a mass murderer of innocent men, women, and children. But as Munya said, Assad has been a mass murderer since 2011. So was his father. Where was the West? Nobody has lifted a finger in all these years when he was doing the killing. The timing is also suspect. Mr. Bill Clinton launched his attack in the middle of Monica Lewinsky scandal. Mr. Trump is launching the attacks in the middle of a very tight noose that's going around his neck by the independent counsel, Mr. Mueller, and his book that James Comey has written, which will be released tomorrow, and excerpts are already coming out at this point. As I said, one doesn't want to be too cynical, but one as a free thinker in a democracy, critical thinking, is forced to ask these questions. These are tough questions, but we need to ask them as citizens. It's a well-known, what is the toll in Syria so far? We are shedding crocodile tears for them, but 400,000, 500,000 people already killed. That's four times as many as were killed in the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, for which we intervened. Late, of course, but we did. 500,000 is probably the figure of the Rwandan genocide. Nothing was done there. Nothing is being done here. Where is the so-called, the great Canadian, the Canadians pioneered this idea of R2P, which is responsibility to protect civilians when they're being killed by their own governments and so on. Not a word has been said about R2P in the last 7 years, either by Canada or by anyone else. US and allies invaded Iraq in 2003 in the name of controlling non-existing weapons of mass destruction. But they have not gone into Syria, which has well-known WMDs and chemical weapons, which have been used, which was invoked again last night, but this has been going on for 7 years. Why is this? One can say, bluntly, that the U.S. has no dog in the fight, as the first president said in Yugoslavia's case in 1991. Do we have a dog in this fight? Why do we care? So America doesn't care. So long as Syria and Assad did not attack our allies, Israel, Jordan, Turkey. So he can kill his people, fine, which is what has been going on for the last little while. So we need not be taken by these pieties and platitudes that are offered to us and say that they mean anything. They don't. They obviously don't. We speak of chemical weapons, what a horrible thing to do. Obviously there's something to chemical weapons, but is there something different by being killed by suffocation by chemical weapons as opposed to just bombs, as opposed to being assassinated in daylight, as opposed to being harassed and so on and so forth that has gone on for the last 7 years? What's the difference? In the end you die, plain die, His father, Hafez al-Assad, had used chemical weapons, if you remember, in 1982 in the Hama massacre. 2,000 people were just gassed to death. Nobody lifted a finger at that time either. 1980 to 1988, the Iran-Iraq war, when Saddam launched a war on Iran, which was supported by Washington and by Saudi Arabia to the tune of $25 billion at that time, which was a big money at that time. Saddam used chemical weapons against Iranian soldiers at that time and Iranian civilians in Khorramshahr. Khorramshahr is south across the border from Basra. I flew with these wounded soldiers and civilians in a Hercules aircraft from Khorramshahr to Tehran. People screaming, shouting, not able to breathe. Victims of chemical weapons used by Saddam Hussein, who was then our friend at that time. The West did not lift a finger then either. Mr. James Mattis, the current defense minister, said just before Trump launched his attacks last night, he said yesterday, we are trying to stop the murder of civilians in Syria. Really, this is Mad Dog Mattis talking. If you remember, this is the guy who leveled to the ground Fallujah in 2004. He was the same guy who ordered the bombing of a tent where people were meeting and 42 people were killed, including 14 children. This is Mad Dog Mattis. He did not get his name for nothing. Now he's claiming that he cares for the civilians of Syria. Speaking of Iraq, since 2003, the invasion and the subsequent events, 1 million Iraqi civilians are dead. This is not me talking, this is not journalists talking, this is the latest estimate from the Washington-based Physicians for Social Responsibility, which is a very responsible group. They came out just a few days ago, taking all of these various Iraq body count and this and that. 1 million civilians dead, not all killed by the Americans, but in the aftermath of the war, 1 million civilians. Just go back. I don't want to depress you some more, but go back, 1991 to 2003, American-led sanctions on Iraq killed 1 million civilians. United Nations figures, slow death under sanctions. 500,000 of them were children. And the then Secretary of State was asked, was it worth it? And she said, yeah, we think it was worth it. 1 million people dead, 500,000 children dead. Was it worth it? Yeah, she was dead. This is Madeleine Albright saying on television. You can Google it. Afghanistan. We care about civilians. since 9/11, 22,000 Afghan civilians dead. Longest war in history, longer than the First World War, longer than the Second World War. We were there ourselves. We lost 56 Canadians. To what end? Afghanistan is still a mess up to this day. Pakistan, 80,000 dead, drone attacks, and all the others who are killing each other. We intervene in Libya. Mr. Obama said we're leading from behind. It was led by the Brits and the French mostly. And Canadians sent their 2 planes too. And Mr. Harper, in fact, arranged for a very successful flypast on Parliament Hill, which cost us $850,000, if you remember, celebrating our great thing in Libya. What did we do? We fractured Libya. Libya cannot come together up to this day. So two bad guys replaced Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, but 2 countries destroyed and millions of people dead. Civilizations destroyed. So what are we doing here? We are really going through a very historic period in our lifetime. Any sweep of history you look at, you will not find figures like this. I mean, except First World War and Second World War and so on. And if you remember, Tommy Frank, the American general who led the war in Iraq and Syria, he was asked, you know, what about all these people dead? And his famous response was, we don't do body counts. We don't do body counts. Muslim blood is cheap. That's what that means. We don't do body counts. By way of comparison, I've given you all these figures which are depressing, but realistic. The famous, infamous IRA troubles, 3,600 people died. The much maligned, rightly so, ISIS, Daesh, they established their caliphate, what, in 2014. They have killed 2,043 people so far, maybe 3,000. The jihadists and Muslim terrorists, 9/11, 3,000 innocent people were murdered on 9/11 by 19 terrorists, Muslim terrorists. Since then, jihadists and so on have killed 119 people, including 2 Canadians in North America, 500 in Europe. But again, another sort of a comparative figure, just to put all this into context, 200,000 Americans have died since 1999 in the opioid crisis. 3,000 died in Canada last year. 30,000 Americans die by guns every year. You know, Obama used to tell his staff, Fewer Americans have been killed by Muslim terrorists in America than die in the bathtub every year in the United States. Which is a long way of saying we have totally lopsided priorities and understanding of what we see. The counter-argument really is that, you know, I mean, life is full of double standards. Life is full of hypocrisies. We all have double standards in our life. Life is not perfect. And geopolitics is less so than others. Still, one has to question all of these things. And the last 2 points I'll make is the following. Mr. Trump is shedding tears for innocent Muslims in Syria. What about the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar? 600,000. Nobody knows the figure. Even Mr. Babre, was special envoy of the Prime Minister, filed a report the other day. And he couldn't bring himself to criticize Aung San Suu Kyi. Oh, he said, she is not really responsible. I mean, she's not really responsible, period. Really? She's an honorary Canadian citizen. We gave her honorary citizenship. We can't raise her voice. And Mr. Ray cannot bring himself to criticize her. We should be demanding that that citizenship be revoked. The citizenship was given to her for certain qualities, and those qualities have been missing because she's a silent partner in the murder of all of these people. So geopolitics gets played out differently at different times. The last point Mr. Trump made last night was the following. You know, he was attacking Iran and Syria for their complicity in Syria. Iran and Russia for their complicity in Syria, rightly so. The nations of the world can be judged by the friends they keep, unquote, Mr. Trump last night. Who are the West's friends in the Syrian neighborhood? Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Since 2015, Saudi Arabia has been waging a war in Yemen. Why? Because it considers Yemen to be in its sphere of influence. The same way that Mr. Vladimir Putin considers Ukraine in its sphere of influence. Saudi Arabia and UAE, who have been waging this war, have been blockading Yemen for the last 2.5 years. 1 million people have cholera in Yemen. We don't hear much about it. My media, my friends, don't cover it much because we don't care. The World Food Program and WHO says Yemen is the world's largest humanitarian crisis outside of Syria. No word, no tears shed, nothing. Mr. Trump is silent. But Saudi Arabia is ally, they supply us with oil. And in fact, when Mr. Trump went on the visit, he was so taken up by these gilded palaces, he has given a green check and a blank check to Crown Prince Mohammed, or whatever his name is, to do whatever he does. United Kingdom, totally silent. But United Kingdom has sold $6.4 billion worth of armaments in the last 3 years to Yemen. Canada, clean Canada, our hands are not clean. We have a $15 billion defense contract with Saudi Arabia. Armored vehicles made not too far from here and shipped to Saudi Arabia. The other friend is Egypt. Mr. General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, Field Marshal, he's our buddy. He has killed 2,000 people in the first democratically elected president after Arab Spring, and there are 40,000 people in jail, according to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Not a word from anyone. So these double standards and so on are important. And these double standards get played out in Canada. I mean, I mentioned Saudi Arabia and so on in a different kind of way. We have seen it, and we can discuss it in question and answer if you want. The Harper government never said a word about Syria, what was going on in Syria for the longest time. The only time he piped up was when Daesh and the Islamic State were going after Yazidi minority. We must go and rescue them. Of course we must rescue them. But the biggest victims have been Sunni Muslims, who are in effect treated like worse than a minority by these thugs of Bashar al-Assad. Not a word. But as soon as Yazidi, why? Because it just fitted the Harper government's great cultural warfare on Muslims that they were waging. And it worked for them. Even Alan Kurdi, that boy whose body was found, and Manya mentioned it, it stirred our conscience. It did not stir Mr. Harper's conscience. If you remember what he said, you know, he said, oh, we can turn ourselves, cry ourselves into grief if you worry about everything. Then second thing, when Canadians, ordinary Canadians, start saying, you know, what about these refugees? Why don't we bring them? He said, no, we cannot bring them. They could be terrorists. That's exactly what Mr. Donald Trump was saying while he was running the campaign. They could be ISIS. They could constitute a 200,000 man army if we let them in. So we cannot let them in because they're all terrorists. In fact, Mr. Harper's candidate in Don Valley North, Joe Daniel, who was an MP, he said this. There's an agenda behind these refugees coming out. No, there's an agenda behind these so-called refugees coming out, he said. And what is the agenda? He was asked by the reporter. He said, quote, oh, to move as many Muslims into European countries, to change these countries in a major way. That's something I certainly do not want to happen in Canada. This is Mr. Harper's candidate. So all of these awful things that I'm talking about, they have repercussions and they have got played out in Canada as well to some extent. But in the end, you know, we say, oh, wasn't it nice Mr. Harper got defeated? You know, that was the end of him. And then, of course, new government came and it welcomed the refugees. 40,000 refugees came. And the biggest complaint in Canada was, where are my refugees? My church-sponsored refugees, why is their application not in yet? So we have governments who are saying one thing and Canadians are saying something quite different, you know? And how many of these 40,000 refugees have turned out to be terrorists? So far, zero, touch wood, you know? So these are the harsh realities that we are dealing with in this world. What can we as Canadians do, you know? We as Canadians should be demanding tougher answers, asking tougher questions of our politicians and demanding answers. And at a very human level, what is all this running through it in the United States, in Europe, in India? There's a kind of Islamophobia that has been fanned since 9/11. And Mr. Harper traded in it, just this short of being totally open. Islamophobia is the new anti-Semitism. Mosques are being vandalized. 6 people gunned down in Quebec City. Women, I mean, the biggest complaint against Islam and Muslims, oh, you don't treat your women well. Yes, we don't. Perhaps worse than others, we don't know. But who are the biggest victims in Canada of Islamophobes? Muslim women. Their hijabs are being pulled down, they're being shoved, they're being pushed, they're being kicked, they're being slapped in public spaces. You know, so hypocrisy knows no bounds. And we need to be clear-headed about these things. And as ordinary citizens and people of goodwill, our duty is to fight Islamophobia at this time. I don't say this because I'm a Muslim, but as a Canadian who happens to be Muslim. And Canadian values are at stake here. Thank you very much.
And once again, that was what happened in Syria. Special thanks to my open source's Guelph co-host, Scotty Hertz, for recording the lecture. And normally this is where I share links on how you can learn more about the people or issues featured in this podcast, and today I'm going to tell you how you can help out with the humanitarian response in Syria. You can donate to the International Rescue Committee, which have provided humanitarian aid to Syrians since 2012, supporting 12 health facilities and 5 schools, and you can learn more about their efforts at rescue.org. You can also support the International Red Cross by donating at icrc.org/en/donate. And you can give to the White Helmets at herofund.org. www.whitehelmets.org/donate/crowdfund. And finally, there's Doctors Without Borders, and you can find out how you can contribute to their efforts at doctorswithoutborders.org/country-region/Syria. And you can find all these links on the show notes page for this episode of the podcast. And that's it for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics. It's Sid Dale. The host of the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean every Monday. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph, and you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. Until then, see you next time.